Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Phillips, Risk Professionals Practice Lead at ISACA International, and welcome to today's podcast. I am joined by Dr. Jack Fruin. He is the head of cyber risk methodology for Visible Risk. He is an active member of ISACA International, an active member of FAIR Institute. He has a number of certifications. Just to name a few, he's a certified data privacy solutions engineer, certified information privacy professional, a certified information security manager, a certified information systems auditor, and he also holds a C-Risk. And I'm going to stop there because we don't have time to continue to read your certifications, Dr. Jack. Welcome.
Thank you, Paul. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. Jack and I have done a lot of work together. So this is another exciting adventure. So today we want to talk about the white paper that we released. I believe it was earlier this year. You were the author of that white paper. It was centered on and focusing on cyber risk and how do we communicate to the board of directors. And it was a very insightful paper. So I just want to jump right in. I think this is a really significant paper, especially as we are in the midst of and coming out of, depending on how you look at it, the pandemic. And I believe in you, and I'm going to go off script right away, which is what I do. I believe that we are, the digital transformation has been heightened. Is that your assessment as well?
Oh, yeah. I think I actually wrote a short piece for ISACA Now about something like this. Like it's. I think we all went from, and I think everybody's personal stories would echo some version of this. We went from, there's no way we could all possibly work from home at the same time to, this is the only way we could possibly work together from now on. And it happened in a very, very short amount of time. So yeah, organizations that had business models that relied on physical artifacts and tokens were just crushed. And, you know, business models that had already invested heavily in digital transformation was a lot more capable and able to weather a lot of the things that happened in the pandemic. So, yeah, I think you're right about that. I think we're all living in a mid or post digital transformation world now. So it's not so much anymore, should you, but how are you doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And as a result, in my mind, as we continue down this digital transformation continuum, if you will, cyber risk, to put it simply, increases. So as a result, I believe this paper was really necessary. So that's really my first question to you. Why is it important to have a understanding of how we should communicate risk, especially cyber risk, to the board of directors? What's so important about that?
Yeah, well, you're right. It is important. And I can tell you a lot of boards are starting to embrace the notion that every company is a technology company now, including theirs. So that necessarily means that they have to start thinking about all of the risk associated with digital and technology business models. This is an important paper because you have two disparate groups of people that are trying to communicate about the same topic. I've been doing, involving myself in the NACD, the National Association of Corporate Directors, and there you see there's a lot of interest in cybersecurity. There's a lot of interest in how that affects them. You know, in a recent NACD survey, they had, the top four concerns that board directors are sharing about their company are, growing business model disruptions. This speaks to digital transformation that we already talked about, slow global economy, increased competition for talent. We see this in cybersecurity all the time. And number four on that list is, changing cybersecurity threats. So boards are aware of this. Boards care about this. So then the next part of this is okay, so they want to hear about it. And they're being told this is what you should look for. So what are we as cybersecurity and and risk professionals doing to meet those expectations. And that's one of the reasons why I thought this was an important paper to put together is it gives people an opportunity to understand a little bit better the concerns that board directors have. And then also, you know, what's the day in the life of a board director like? How do they think about governance of an organization versus operations? And then what are they looking for in terms of operations? And, you know, how do you speak that language very well? I tried in a concise way to sort of tell a little bit of that story and then also provide some information around, you know, how cybersecurity professionals and security organizations can think about organizing their reporting to make it much more consumable by board directors.
So one of the things when we talk about the board of directors and senior management, and one of the things you pointed out in the paper is viewing cyber risk as a strategic risk. So what does that mean? And if that is the view of the senior leadership of an organization, how are they operating with that view in mind?
Yeah, this is absolutely critical. And I leveraged some of the Asaka Journal work that I had done last year as well to talk about this in this white paper. And this is critical. You have to think about the cybersecurity frameworks that we're all familiar with. They normally sort of stop at the cybersecurity technology thing. They don't go the extra mile to talk more about how does this impact your organization. So things that board directors care a lot about are strategic plans and the objectives of the organization, you know, why it exists and what it's trying to accomplish in the next year, in the next 18 months, next 5 years. So finding ways to connect a cybersecurity story to the overarching story that your organizational leadership is telling is absolutely critical. If they're talking about increasing sales in the current geography this year, if they're talking about expanding into new product lines or acquiring companies or expanding into new geographies, it's absolutely critical to recast and rephrase the cybersecurity things that you care about. They're absolutely critical at the level that we're dealing with them at into these higher level conversations around, you know, if we can't meet the goals and objectives of the organization, then we're going to fail in these strategic initiatives. And how might you do that? You know, when we begin to expand into another geography, we have to worry about additional regulatory concerns or additional attack surface, and our threat profile changes because of that. So we need to think about these things to be able to do that. It's at the same time incredibly foolish to think that we can talk about very granular vulnerabilities, you know, to board directors, and then also not have them wonder how that affects the strategic profile of the organization. Their concern is governance. Their concern is the overarching questions that boards ask are, is management doing the right things and to move us along on our strategic goals? So if you are unable to think about security and risk in that way and communicate it that way, then you're not going to be perceived as being efficient and competent in the things that the board directors care about.
Yeah, well, so let's take that. So we want to think, we want the board of directors, senior management to view cyber risk as a strategic risk. But you also mentioned we don't want to be too granular when we communicate with the board of directors. So I guess my question is, let's frame this. You have a cybersecurity program, an organization has a cybersecurity program, and they have a board of directors who obviously has oversight responsibilities. So talk to us about how the leaders of that cybersecurity program should interact with the board of directors, meaning how often should they be communicating with them? What should they be communicating with them? At what level, meaning at what level of detail? So talk to us about that oversight and how it looks.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a great segue into thinking about board structures and what boards do. Boards vary in many ways in terms of the size of them for public and private organizations and nonprofit boards. They all kind of look different. The typical model is for a publicly traded company, there are a few required committees that they have to have. You're going to look for a compensation committee. This is the board that's largely responsible for things like HR concerns. You have an audit committee, you have a finance committee. For all but a few select financial services companies, the cybersecurity and the risk function is typically going to report up into some sort of audit function at the board level. Some boards have risk committees and they focus solely on risk. Some of those organizations may find that their cybersecurity functions report to both of those committees and they share those kind of responsibilities and obligations. But that's sort of where the oversight comes from. And oftentimes, because it's now a top four, top five concern for a lot of boards, you may find that your cybersecurity reporting goes to a full board for consideration and review. But you may meet more often with just that audit committee chair. Throughout all of this, the idea is to make sure that you have identified what the top strategic plans are for the organization and then how that filters down throughout the different layers of the company. So what are our top goals? And then what are the parts of the business? What are the divisions or the overarching management programs that are in place to achieve those kinds of things? There is this sort of a translation layer that occurs between management layers of thinking about business products and strategies, and then the IT systems that support that. There's clearly going to be shared infrastructure across all of these things, but there's probably going to be some sort of key applications, key systems, key infrastructure that supports particular lines of business, particular products, particular services that your organization is offering. And that's where you begin to translate back down into the organization. Okay, so for this particular set of servers and database pairs that support this application that's keyed to delivering this particular product, here's sort of the risk and threats associated with those things going wrong and bad things happening to them. And that sort of allows you to narrow the focus at the top of the organization in your board reporting to say, I mean, just imagine how amazing it would be to be able to say, here's the cybersecurity risk associated with this, with product line X or service line B. And this gives us the opportunity to think about that. And then the next question that's going to be anticipated and should be is, okay, so how do we fix this? Is this okay? Or are we looking at it with the right amount of risk for our organization? And then if not, how do we change that? What are the things that we need to fix? And that mapping, that connection back down into an infrastructure stack of some kind allows you to say, oh, well, great. These cybersecurity frameworks, which we're familiar, has a list of 15 or 20 things that we think are important to do. Five of those are missing or deficient, and those are the ones that we need to focus on. Flipping those things, we'll flip it on the upper reporting brackets, and the next thing you know, the board has a key bit of insight into how they can manage those things at a very granular level. The cybersecurity programs that we're familiar with, a security operations team, a risk team, perhaps a BISO team that does business liaisons, those things can be layered into there as well. But boards care a lot about governance, so they want to know that when you're looking at governance for cybersecurity organizations, that you're doing the right things. So those things fit in there as well. It's not simply just a list of control objectives that we need to think about as well, but oftentimes it's security programs broadly and how those connect to a set of scenarios that can bring about failure in an organization's goals and objectives.
So Dr. Jack, what does risk quantifications fit in with that whole scenario that you just explained?
Yeah, this is an important topic, so much so that we wrote a follow-on paper covering just this exact topic. Yeah. So boards are very familiar with financial projections and forecasting. Most organizations have some function that's doing this all over the place. We have sales forecasts, we have expense forecasts. And for publicly traded companies, they have to signal to the market, what those projections are and ensure that they're based upon, solid estimation techniques. For some reason, we've avoided this in cybersecurity for a long time, but there is a very growing and very vibrant community of people that are beginning to bring these types of disciplines, namely thinking about cybersecurity from a quantitative financial perspective, into their management and ultimately up to their boards. There's a couple key questions I think that come about that drive organizations' need for cyber risk quantification or CRQ. Typically, when boards begin to think about and when organizational risk management functions begin to think about, do we have the right amount of cybersecurity insurance? Do we have the right amount of insurance? You have to sort of begin to ask very simple questions like, well, how much do I think I'm going to lose and how much do I need to cover that? These are very financially focused questions, clearly, and also hint subtly at things like your your appetite for financial losses associated with cybersecurity. Just like when we all purchase, you know, property and casualty lines for ourselves, we have to think about what's the deductible, what's the premium, is that reasonable to us? Are we okay paying out of pocket this much in order to get this much of coverage later? All those things really matter, and this sort of drives a financial conversation for board as well. Particular to financial services companies, although it should be a practice of a lot of companies, is the notion of something called capital allocation. So the official rule states that for all operational risks, of which cybersecurity is one of them, capital must be allocated to them in some way. What you can think about this as is sort of like a rainy day fund. If something bad happens, we have money in the bank to sort of cover that. And a lot of organizations should think about, you know, putting money aside for bad things. Otherwise, they have to pay out of their current revenues, which could definitely depress them in the marketplace if that's something that they're worried about from a credit rating perspective. So cyber risk quantification answers those kinds of questions, and that sort of drives this notion, at least from the very top of the organization, how do we measure the things that we're doing that way? Now, other sources of interest around cyber risk quantification come from trying to prioritize budget and spending and a list of broken things that we have to care about. So those same missing controls or deficient controls that we talked about and being tied into this hierarchical list of things going up to the board is oftentimes numerous for a lot of organizations. And likewise, despite budgets being very generously allocated to some organizations, they're still not infinite. And in some cases, they're even getting tightened. So how do you allocate a limited number of dollars to a near infinite number of things that could be fixed, accounting for a dynamic adversarial threat component that changes daily, weekly, and monthly? And that's really where cyber risk quantification comes into play. It's better understanding the top things that we have to worry about outside of us subjectively saying that it's high, medium, and low. We still can translate CRQ values into high, medium, and low. In fact, we should. That same conversation around risk appetite comes into play here. Are we willing to lose money associated with this type of failure, or you know, do we need to reallocate that money somewhere else to make things better? So CRQ kind of looks to add ranges of estimates around what particular loss scenarios look like. And it's critical also, thinking back to that same hierarchy of cybersecurity controls leading all the way up to organizational objectives, to better understand that. If we had a ransomware attack, how much money would we lose? If we had a ransomware attack on this particular system that's attached to this business line that leads to this organizational objective, it's a little easier to answer that question. And when you do that, that gives you the opportunity to really sort of think about dollars associated with these attacks. What's our response cost going to be? Well, how many hours do you think we're going to take to respond to it? Do we have to bring in outside help? And what's their hourly rate? What's our loaded cost rate for internal people working on this kind of thing? All those kind of things come into play in thinking about how we respond to this. But externally, too, we have to think about, is this going to cause us to lose customers or lose transactions from our customers? If so, how many and how much? And what do you think that's worth to the organization? You'll find that as you begin this, as a cybersecurity professional, as you begin to get better connected with line of business leaders and get better connected with the way that the company operates and makes money, these questions come a little bit easier. And you get this all-important connection that all security organizations want, which is to bring you closer to the business, that sort of security business integration, that sort of a holy grail for security organizations, comes better when you understand and can speak the language that that business cares about.
Wow. Well, that was a lot. But no, not at all. By the way, I think we should do another entire podcast on risk quantification, cybersecurity risk quantification, and highlight the paper we worked on.
I think you heard it right here. I think we're going to do that.
Good. So I want to talk to you about two more things, Dr. Jack. I want to talk about, one, laws and regulations and risk appetite. So first, let's talk about laws and regulations. What are some of the significant or major regulations that we as cybersecurity professionals and risk professionals should be communicating to the board of directors? I know you mentioned in the paper, you talked about PCI DSS and GDPR. So kind of elaborate on those things for us.
Yeah, I think you need to understand, again, it comes from your business model. It's geography focused. Are you doing business in the European Union? GDPR attaches to those types of things. If you're handling certain types of data, you have to understand if you're doing business in California, you have CCPA concerns, and these things change over time. And it requires a very close connection with the cybersecurity team and the risk team to a chief privacy officer, to a chief legal officer. They should become your best friend in this. They have insights into things that are very helpful in understanding those business models and in communicating risk. Some organizations, risk reports up through legal because that's how they think about it from a compliance perspective. So better understanding and communicating these types of concerns and what non-compliance means to the board is very, very helpful that way. If you're accepting credit card transactions and you're not outsourcing that, or you're issuing credit cards, those things clearly attach to a PCI DSS compliance need. So letting the board know, one, that you're aware of the things that they're probably aware of regulation-wise, and two, making sure that you communicate to them, here's what failures in cybersecurity could mean to these types of security and privacy regulations. That's an important consideration and actually helps you better understand what loss looks like. So many organizations are concerned about what non-compliance looks like. So helping to communicate that with the assistance of a legal team gives you the opportunity to form another connection in that business hierarchy, but also appear as if you're on the same page with those teams. So I think it's a very strong message to be able to say, these 10 failures we think are attached to these scenarios where, in this case, regulators are the attackers. Not that we think of them in an adversarial kind of way, but they're the ones that are going to bring about loss for an organization. If you banks, for example, can have their entire charters pulled, or they can be limited in how they're able to do business. So, one of those board concerns I mentioned earlier that's further down the list is increasing regulatory needs. And all the regimes associated with managing that are highly complex and highly difficult. I was listening to a podcast the other day around some of the details around, how in the U.S., the regulatory framework around cryptocurrency is changing and how they're thinking about it. And man, that's really complex. And I'm glad I'm not a lawyer because I don't know if I can keep up with that kind of stuff. But understanding broadly that these are concerns that organizations have, if we're going to start accepting cryptocurrency as payment, well, that has implications to the organization from a compliance perspective. We need to make sure that we communicate what that looks like and that there could be risk associated with it. Not that we should avoid it altogether. No organization competes better by avoiding risk. They compete better by managing risks that they do have. And part of that comes from ensuring that we're communicating it appropriately to the board so that they can make the right decisions.
Yeah. And speaking of managing risk, one of the most important things in my mind is risk appetite. So let's talk about that. So I think this is going to be a 3 or 4 part question here. So one, explain to our audience what risk appetite is and versus risk tolerance and why that's important, or if it's important to an organization, especially as it relates to how they make business decisions. So what is risk appetite? What is risk tolerance, and is that important to an organization?
Yeah, absolutely. I think my experience with this has been interesting over the years. I've seen a number of cybersecurity risk appetite statements that are very wishy-washy and sort of say things like, well, we understand that we can't avoid all risks. We don't want to accept anything high risk. Well, that's baloney. You're accepting high risk things all day long. It's high risk to offer product and services in a competitive marketplace. Like, that's just how that works. So we have to sort of better understand, what high risk means as translated into something else. I think a lot of cybersecurity professionals, when they see those types of statements, are simultaneously emboldened by what they think is a management commitment to doing all the cybersecurity things well, but also disheartened when they realize that we're going to risk accept some findings and some broken controls that just we can't fix right now. And how do you sort of square that and understanding that, we have other objectives in the organization. So, you know, I give some examples of how to translate that into financial terms and to put some bar graphs around that in the paper. I found those to be relatively successful. But, you know, how much risk you want in your appetite for risk is a pretty subjective thing in general. So the important thing when implementing CRQ is to better understand how to translate subjective things into quantitative things and to effectively express the amount of uncertainty you have around a subjective feeling with numbers. And that's what things like appetite and tolerance allow you to do. I was able to get some quantitative cyber risk appetite thresholds put in place by effectively offering management a couple different options. Those same types of bars and graphs that are in that white paper, I sort of show them and I say, when I originally did this, I put a couple different versions on there. Well, here's what it looks like at this number. Here's what it looks like at this number. And a third number, you know, which of these feels better to you? It's a very feel-based kind of thing, and that's okay. But then you begin to report out on that. And sometimes that's what accelerates that, is showing, well, here's what our risk scenarios look like expressed against the first, second, or third tolerance over time. And then eventually you can get them to say, okay, well, these ones are fine, but that one's not okay. And then you sort of derive it indirectly that way. I introduced the concept of CALS in there, capacity, appetite, and limits. Capacity is more like this full scale. If we had to, you know, liquidate everything and pay it out, you know, what are we capable of handling? This is sort of like a stress test kind of thing. If we had to draw down our insurance, if we had to hit all of the capital reserves that we had, and we had an event that, you know, occurred at like the 95th and 99th percentile, what could we tolerate? We want to be far away from this as possible, right? That's sort of the idea. Appetite kind of sits somewhere in the middle and reflects that general feeling of, you know, here's kind of where I would like to be. Tolerance or limits, as I call them, is a sort of lower threshold where we begin to say, we've hit this early warning indicator, and now we need to start thinking about, do we deal with this in the current planning period or the next planning period? Because if this continues, and trending helps to show this story even better, we're going to be hitting our appetite limit soon, and that's a concern. So that's what I think really good risk appetite management from a quantitative perspective looks like for organizations. Thinking about expressing these values this way and then managing to those over time so that organizations have the opportunity to make corrections either in the thresholds or in the underlying risk that we're measuring.
Dr. Jack, I wonder if you would indulge me to ask one last question.
Sure thing. Let's do it.
All right. Boy, this might be a trick question, but I'm sure it's not for you. And it's going back to risk quantification. Do you think an organization can effectively manage risk without doing risk quantification? In other words, they're basically doing risk qualitation, if you will. I probably mispronounced that word, but they're doing the high, the mediums, the lows.
Right.
Yeah, what do you think?
I think it's difficult to know if you're managing risk well if you're not measuring it. How would you know if you're managing risk well? Well, we have, you know, 10 high-risk things today, and we have a different set of 10 things tomorrow. Is that right for the organization? In all other aspects of the business, would that be acceptable? We're managing, high priority phone calls from customers first. Or how do you define that? We just sort of, you know, decide which customers we think are important or not. There's usually some criteria for that. Are we handling, high value customer accounts before others? Well, you know, how do you define that? Ultimately, it comes down to some sort of quantitative measure. I think, especially moving into the future, we're going to spend a lot more time thinking about how do we justify these things. A quick story about this. I find myself spending a lot of time talking about and interacting with teams that are called model risk management teams. This is a super meta kind of quantitative function that exists primarily in financial services organizations. And they're charged with managing the risk of risk models. And this is really kind of fun and interesting, but it really comes down to looking at a variety of different options for thinking about risk and then choosing the best one, at knowing that none of them are perfect, but all of them have these sort of flaws. So how are you accounting for those flaws? What are the assumptions that you're making in your models? And are those assumptions valid? Where's the data coming from to make these kinds of decisions? Usually model risk management teams serve as sort of a gating function to getting quantitative results of any kind up into board level and executive level reporting. But what I've been experiencing over the past several years is that a lot more of these model risk management teams are very interested in cybersecurity models broadly, not just the CRQ models, but all the models. So if you start reporting things on high, medium, and low, as a measure of maturity, it's important for you to be able to say, how do I know this is high, medium, or low? And then how do I know if I was wrong? It's very easy to say, I predicted a particular control deficiency would cause a loss scenario between this amount and this amount. But then if that actually happens, I can do what's called backtesting and say, oh, actually, I was right. The right value did fall between there, or I was wrong. I needed to expand my estimates and update that for the next forecast that I'm doing. It's very difficult to do the same thing with a simple high, medium, low indicator. So I think you can, organizations do qualitative risk management all the time. But I don't think that's the right question. I think the right question is it an indicator of a mature and optimally functioning risk function to do things qualitatively? I don't think that's true.
Sure. Awesome. Well, I think we may have covered about maybe 25% of what's in the paper. It's a great paper. So I want to encourage our listeners to go and download the paper because it's full of great information. And maybe I'll get you on the hook to maybe do a follow-up on that paper as well. So that's two sessions that I got you on the hook. But I'll stop there. Dr. Jack, thank you so much for your time and your expertise. And we appreciate your support to ISACA and to the risk community at large.
Thank you, Paul. My pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to this ISACA podcast.